As Brother Danny said, it's 3 weeks until our gospel meeting begins. We're striving to have 175 on Sunday morning, March the 8th. Now, you remember back a few years ago, we had 277 on Sunday morning when we had this concerted effort to ask our neighbors and friends to come on that occasion. Brother Austin Mobley spoke for us both times that Lord's Day, and we had two wonderful services. Now, we can do it again. Let's just think about 5 to 10 people that we can ask to come, send them a letter, or invite them on the phone or face-to-face, and let's have a large assembly here 3 weeks from today. It'd be nice if we had 200, Pete. We can handle that. And I think it'd be done. And then Saturday night, March the 7th, at 7 o'clock, our singing. And we look forward to it. Brother Randy Mullins said this past week that he thinks he's going to be able to come to the singing and even lead singing during our gospel meeting. And that's good news for the quick recovery after back surgery, our brother Mullins and his being able to direct our singing as far as he knows at the time being. Brother and sister Fred Etheridge are with us today from the Brown Street Church in Akron, Ohio. Fred had open heart surgery just a few months ago. He became ill in England and was hospitalized in London and flew home later after some medical attention, entered the Akron General Hospital, had surgery. Everything went real well, and it's good to see them, having them visiting with us a couple days. And, of course, the Fosters, no strangers to us. We're delighted to have Phil and Vicki and their children with us this morning. And if the others, we appreciate your presence. Don't want to overlook anybody, but I'm not aware at the moment of anybody else. Open your Bible, if you would, please, to the 13th chapter of the book of Judges. Judges 13, 14, 15, 16 is the story of Samson. We might entitle this lesson this morning, A Weak Strong Man. He was strong physically by the aid of God, I might add. The power in and of itself, ladies and gentlemen, wasn't in his hair. Hair doesn't give you strength. If that's so, there are a lot of us around I've seen that are powerful men. But that means I don't have much. But the hair didn't give him the strength. It was God who gave him that. And there's a passage of Scripture in verse 20 of the 16th chapter which indicates that. And he knew not, that the Lord was departed from him. Now that's after his hair was cut. It says the Lord departed from him. That's where his power came from. But though he was strong physically, he was weak spiritually. In these chapters, 13 through 16... by and large, is a one man's fight with the Philistines. Samson was judge for 20 years. There are two passages, one in the 15th chapter and another in the 16th chapter. And the Philistines was the one who was the imminent enemy of the people of God. And so here was Samson who rose up. His father was Manoah in the 13th chapter, and his mother is not named. Manoah's wife was barren. And so a prayer was made unto Jehovah. And God responded. He heard that. And this woman was able to bear a child, a son by the name of Samson. We see this on other occasions. Children of prayer. Here was Isaac. Here was Samuel. John the Baptist. And in this case, Samson. And the record tells us that he was a Nazarite. And the rules or regulations of the Nazarite vow is in Numbers, the 6th chapter. You couldn't touch a dead body. Or you couldn't drink alcoholic beverages. Nor could you cut your hair. And as we proceed in this story this morning, we learn or we see that in the case of Samson, every one of them was violated. So he was a spiritual weakling in so many ways. Now look at his parents. His parents were people of prayer. Look at verse 8, if you please, of the 13th chapter. Then Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O my Lord, let the man of God which thou didst send come again unto us, that is the angel, and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born. There's a good lesson, brethren, for all of us as parents, especially when we have youngsters, that we seek God's guidance, that this child will be reared in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. One of the gravest responsibilities that we have as parents is the development, especially spiritually, of our sons and daughters. And in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, ye fathers. And he didn't say in that text mothers, though mothers have an obligation. But in that text, fathers. And I'll tell you, fathers, much of our discipline, and by discipline I mean the whole treatment of the child, the whole development of the child, is turned over to the mother. And we simply shirk our responsibilities in this regard. God puts the primary responsibility on the shoulders of the man, the father. The Bible teaches that marriage is a patriarchal relationship. In our society today, it's become greatly matriarchal. The mothers are the ones who take care of the home, and the mothers are the ones who rear the children and discipline the children. And dad, what's he do? Well, he earns the bacon, maybe, as we say. And he comes home, and he may take off then to the golf course or fishing, or he may just have some television he wants to watch, and it's mama's job to take care of the kids. But you read in Deuteronomy chapter 6, and here in Ephesians 6, and God turns this, or gives this duty to the fathers. Ye fathers, you teach your children. You train them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And so they wanted to God's guidance, teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born. Some of us today, we turn to the psychologist. You remember when Dr. Spock was so popular, and he had a lot of good things to say. But Dr. Spock was a libertine when it came to children. But interesting about Dr. Spock was that he said, after all those years, he said, I made a mistake. It was all wrong. And if he'd taken the principles from the Bible, friends, he would have known that he was wrong initially. That doesn't mean all psychologists are bad. They're just those out there who think they got all the answers and never discipline the child by chastising the child. Always be positive. And we hear a lot today about positive reinforcement. They say don't spank. Well, I don't know why. Here's this old cliche, which is based in Proverbs 13, verse 24, spare the rod and spoil the child. And I remember when Jim Deason, the preacher down in Tennessee, he took his children over to a gospel meeting close by some years ago. One of the boys was acting up, and he took him to the vestibule. The vestibule, the acoustics, it just bounced around back and forth forever out there. Here was the ceiling that was plaster, I guess, and it was just ringing out there. And he gave him a few good licks, and here's a brother came out and said, what are you doing to that child? Said, quit that. Well, Jim said, you get back in there and you be quiet. Said, this is my youngin'. Well, I don't know whether that was the right response to the brother or not, but it was. And he was doing the right thing about it. And I won't tell you today, he has fine young boys and a lovely teenage girl. But the thing is, we as parents need to seek the Lord how we're going to rear our children. And let me tell you, brethren, as soon as they're born is when the discipline starts. Not when they're 6 and 8 years old. And I get so disgusted at times when I see youngsters who talk back to their parents and their mother and will kick their mother in the shin and will spit on their mother and are rude and discourteous. And I see these children out in the stores and they pull these temper tantrums, and I say, I know exactly what they do at home. They pull that, they do that at home, and mama or daddy, he comes over and he pacifies the child, and whatever the child wants, he gets because he knows that a temper tantrum works. Now, that is learned, friends. And we start when they're little tots. And we practice discipline. And let me tell you something else. We show them Jesus Christ in our lives at home. Now, if we don't, we can bring them to church all of their life, young life. And it may be, most likely, that they're not going to have too much interest in church. 1 hour on Sunday morning and maybe an hour on Wednesday night. If they're not taught at home about Jesus Christ and they see in us the reflection of principles of righteousness and fairness and godliness and all of that. Well, here's these parents. They were godly parents. They were interested parents. They were praying parents, but their hearts were broken. Because in spite of all of that training and upbringing and the lives they lived, their son did not conduct himself in an honorable way. And I'll say this, brethren, as parents, we can do the best we know how. And sometimes our children are disappointments. And that doesn't mean necessarily that we have failed as parents. It may mean that our child has free moral agency and he's exercising his will. In the Old Testament, our first parents, Adam and Eve, were under the direct tutelage of God, and yet they sinned and were expelled from the Garden of Eden. We can teach, we can train, we can live the right kind of life, and they could still go astray. But I remember what the wise man said in Proverbs 22 and verse 6. He said, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he was old, he will not depart from it. I think that's a general statement. I think I'm persuaded that we can do that, and still sometimes they'll depart from it. But generally, friends, I think that's so, that if we do our job and live as we should, we're going to save our children. Samson's sins were many. One was a refusal to listen to the counsel of his parents. He saw this woman, Philistine woman, in a city close by, Timnah, and he was interested in her. In verse 1 of chapter 14, and Samson went down to Timnath and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. He came up and told his father and his mother and said, I have seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me. That's the way they worked that then. You get her for me. There's going to be some money involved and so forth. Arrangements be made in all of this. But you get her for me. Well, his father said, and his mother, is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren or among all my people that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines? Sometimes I ask that about members of the church. Isn't there somebody among us that we can marry besides going out to the Philistines? Now, let me say a thing or two. I'd rather a son or daughter of mine to marry a non-Christian who has high moral principles and ambition and is responsible and loves and his mate, this non-Christian, loves her or him, than some deadbeat who calls himself a member of the church or a Christian. Now, there's more to it than just being a member of the church. I've seen members of the church that I wouldn't want for one moment a child of mine to marry because they're irresponsible, they don't have any ambition. Their Christian life is not above reproach, but they're members of the church. Now, that's just my own feeling, my own opinion about the matter. But they should be, as we consider marriage for life, marrying a Christian. Somebody says, why, preacher? Because the dangers involved of being influenced in the other direction. You ever stop thinking about that? I've seen it over and over and over. Who's the strongest, the Christian or the non-believer? We don't have a mate who can support, someone to stand by us, someone to confide in concerning spiritual matters, someone to help us to raise the children up to be New Testament Christians. That's why I say we need to marry a member of the church. But interesting in this lesson, brethren, that in the providence of God, there was a purpose for his taking this woman. In verse 4, but his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. And so this could be used in the providence of God for the defeat of the Philistines. But he refused to listen to his parents, and sometimes we say, well, they're old-fashioned, and they don't know anything. And here's a young fellow talks about his old man. Now, I'll tell you what, the way I feel, if a 15-year-old boy, mine, came up to me, and he spoke of me that way, unless it was in a facetious way, and we understood that, I'd be tempted to slap him right across the mouth. Young man, the truth of it, however, is that I should have taught him way back there about that when he was a little tot. And it wouldn't necessitate my, I guess, losing my temper, but that's one thing. The wise man said in Proverbs 13, verse 1, the wise man hears his father's instructions. In Proverbs 15 and verse 5, a fool despises his father's instruction. I got a little quote here in the bulletin that at 4 years old, we got all the questions. At 18 years old, we got all the answers. And who was it Mark Twain talking about his father? He said, when I was 16, he said, I thought he was the dumbest fellow. He said, didn't know anything. He said, now I'm 21. He said, I'm amazed how much the old man has learned in 5 years. And they had the experience. That doesn't mean everything her dad says or her mama says is so. But the thing is, they've had the wisdom. They got the wisdom. They've had the experience. They've been down life's roads, and they can see some things that we as youngsters cannot see. And I remember when I was a boy, about 16, I was determined I was going to go to town. And my mom said, no, you're not going, this weather's bad. I said, I'm going. She said, no, you're not. And she won that battle. One day my brother, he thought he didn't want to go to school. And so the bus was coming or getting ready to come, and he crawled in under the table, and she held the bus up, and she found him, and she got him by the back of the neck and yanked him out of there and said, you get out there and you get to school. Now, I like that approach. I like it, brethren, when it comes to school, when it comes to the church, that you get ready and you go into church. And no questions about it. We don't get up and Sunday morning and argue around or talk around whether we're going to church today. That's part of our schedule. Do you get up on Monday morning if you're employed or working at General Motors and you say, well, I don't know whether I'm going to work today or not? Do you? If you're in school, do you get up and debate whether you're going to go or not? You see, church, brethren, has become just sort of an optional thing, secondary, and it always gets the back burner with a lot of us. Don't you get tired of that with that kind of attitude? That's what it is. It's the back burner. It gets second place. Everything else has precedence. We go to work. We need to work, yes. We do our thing, but Sunday morning has no place for us. And I've seen brethren, I've seen people, and here's Brother Pete over here, come when he almost has to crawl in, you see. I was over in eastern Ohio some years ago in a gospel meeting in Woodsfield, and there was an elderly lady there, I'll never forget it. She was 87. She had a cane. She came every night, even the nights it snowed. She was there. We can find reasons to satisfy ourselves, every kind of excuse in the world for not coming. Somebody says, I'm sick, and sometimes we are, aren't we, Pete? We're sick. But bless your heart, I can be sick and sit on this fine padded pew as much as I can sit in my home, many times, depending on what kind of sickness it is. I feel bad, and you feel bad. We go to work feeling bad. I preach sometimes sick. And I think in 37 or 8 years, I've only missed maybe one time or so preaching because of sickness. Well, then, do you get sick? Well, yeah, I get sick. Do you feel bad at times? Yeah, I feel bad at times. But I come anyway. Somebody says it's your job. Well, if it's the place where it's my job to come to church, then I need to hang it up. I need to quit. Well, here was also Samson's evil associations. In the 14th chapter, he married, though the marriage was never consummated, he married this woman in Timnath, this Philistine. And then we find him in the 16th chapter going into a harlot at Gaza. Now his scruples, his morals weren't too high. He yielded to temptation. Somebody said, if you lie down with the dogs, you're going to get up with the fleas. That's sort of an odd saying, but that's so, friends. We cannot run with the wrong crowd and come out smelling like a rose. Can't be that way. I remember Fred Dennis used an illustration about coal mines over there in that part of the country. He said, you put on a nice, clean, white shirt or a clean suit and said you go in those coal mines. He said, you're going to come out with coal dust on you. You're going to come out black. That's true. And it's true as far as our associations. Here he is with Delilah. Delilah helped in the downfall of Samson. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, that evil companionship corrupts good morals. And that's so. In Proverbs 4, verse 14, enter not into the path of the wicked, and go not in the way of evil men. I saw this sign in a marquee, out of all places, a savings and loan. And it said, quote, better to be alone than to be with evil companions. I wonder if the manager in there was not a religious person. Because what he said was so. We see the influence, the effect of evil companionship with Solomon and all his wives. They led him off into idolatry. We see demons who permitted this world to influence him to abandon or leave Jesus Christ. Demas hath forsaken thee, having loved this present world. And parents, let me offer this advice for what it's worth. I'd want to make sure who my youngsters are playing with and associating with. You know, sometimes we get embarrassed by a little tot comes along and he says a four-letter word and we said, We get red-faced and we're startled. Where did you get that? Sometimes they get it from the ones they associate with. What about the character of the ones they're playing with or the ones they're going around with? And I'll tell you, brethren, if you let children associate with members of the church who are indifferent, who are worldly minded, who have no commitment for the Lord Jesus Christ, chances are they're going to become the same way. It just works in reverse. It should work the other way. In a congregation, if you got a person, a young man, a young woman who have character, and others can look up to and emulate their life, chances are that there'll be a great influence on all the youngsters. But if you've got some yahoo, he's maybe a basketball player, he's a real popular football player, he's a macho man, you know, and they look up to him, and his Christian morals, his Christian, his spirituality is very, very low. Then that's going to have an impact on the other youngsters. I was over to Indianapolis, and I'm not going to get through with this. I'll finish it tonight. But I was over to Indianapolis in a gospel meeting at Lafayette Heights, where Mo Hafley is the preacher. Three rows right there, of teenagers, maybe 12, some were 12, but teenagers, boys and girls, all sitting right there with their Bibles open. And I go in gospel meetings, and here are teenagers who come by and are in the vestibule or whatever. And what means to me immensely is we appreciated what you saw. And there's some here, brethren, who not but a few weeks ago, after I talked on a very controversial and for a moment or two a very heated matter, and those people said, I appreciated what you had to say. And namely, I was talking about a boy, a man wearing hair down over his shoulder, which isn't any place for, in our culture. You might find a Chinese, he'd have a pigtail down. That might mean one thing in their culture, but in our culture, you know. And something that distinguishes men from women, from boys from girls. But I appreciated what these young men had to say in regard to that. And I want to tell you, brethren, all of our youngsters haven't gone to the dogs. A lot of them have. A lot of them aren't worth shooting. A lot of them are just need to be kicked. And if you're in the Old Testament, they wouldn't see the light of day because they'd be pushing up daisies. These recalcitrant, incorrigible children in the Old Testament didn't sass their mama. When they did, that's the last time they ever did, or anybody else, because they put them to death. And then we've got our little darlings today that just run the house, whatever they want to do. And I'm like Ira North said years ago. He's talking about rearing children. And Ira, of course, I knew Ira real well and his daddy. And Ira said, my daddy said, he always told me, he said, son, he said, if I own the fiddle, I call the tune. And that's true with parents and youngsters. If we own the fiddle, we call the tune. But kids today just lead some parents around by the nose. And some parents are so naive and dense that they can see all of this, but should be able to see this veneer of what's going on, but they can't. Maybe we're blinded because of it's all on our own. I don't know. Many times we are. But here he was with the right, wrong kind of association and one other thing, and then we've got to quit. And that is Samson gave in. He gave in to the woman at Timnath when he told her the riddle and her constant egging him on or urging him. He gave in to Delilah and told where the secret of his strength was. He gave in to the temptation at Gaza with this harlot. Daniel didn't give in. What's the difference in Daniel and Samson? Daniel as a teenager in a distant land, taken captive, made in Daniel 1 and verse 8 a resolution that I would not drink the king's wine or eat his meat. And he was ready to take the consequences. And that was a young man. That wasn't somebody 50 and 60 years old. That was a teenager. That's why I say we got a lot of teenagers today who are just a delight to be around. We got teenagers today who love the Lord, who'll talk about the Lord. They got teenagers today with high moral principles. They don't wallow in the gutter and come to church on Sunday morning and commune. Their principles are high. Their lives are impeccable during the week. It's like a young man down in Alabama. He was a football star. And that was then Florence State. It's North Alabama University, I believe now. But he was going to be given a party. And they were going to have a dance and some things. And becoming to a Christian, he says, no, I can't do that. He says, I'm a Christian. And they thought so much of him that they just said, well, we can handle that. Said, we'll just leave out the drinking. We'll take care of the dancing. Said, what kind of party do you want? Now, he must have had a lot of respect. Here was a young lady out in Arizona some few years ago who was elected homecoming queen. But in order to be crowned, she had to attend the high school dance. And she got before that group of students in chapel, and she said, I appreciate your confidence in me and elect me homecoming queen, but I must decline because my religious convictions will not permit me to attend the dance. And they stood and gave her an applause. Now that's character, ladies and gentlemen, and they learn that at home. Where they learned. Is that asking too much for us? Are we being prudes in order to raise the standard to what we're talking about at the present? No. He also committed fornication, violated one of the Ten Commandments. He surrendered the source of his strength, and he became disloyal to his vow. And that's the kind of man Samson was. A spiritual weakling, and yet a man of strength. If you're in the audience this morning and you're not a Christian, as we sing this song, we want you to come and be baptized into Christ. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. What a wonderful, wonderful promise that's offered in the Great Commission. Never before could we have the forgiveness of our sins. And I tell you, brethren, what bothers me sometimes is I look at myself and wonder if I really appreciate it. I've been around it so long. I've talked about it so many years. Do I appreciate it? And that's why that little statement in the bulletin today concerning those in Russia, when they heard the story of Jesus, they wept. We don't weep. We want to go home. We don't weep. We said, when's the preacher going to get through? And I grant that there's extremes and abuses and all that and time and so forth. But have we lost the feel, the emotions for what all is involved in this? And I'm not talking about you particularly. I look at myself. Is it just something to take for granted? Is preaching just a job? Is it something just a profession? Is worship just a routine? Is Jesus dying a ho-hum event? Or is it something there that lifts up the spirit, the heart, invigorates the soul? And we never know, because we've never been without it. Here they had something they hadn't had since the Revolution. Here now they can read the Bible. Here now they can hear for the first time in freedom and the good news of Jesus Christ and so easily convinced, the story goes. Why not come today and accept the Christ, the Messiah, who gave his life that we might live? Why not come if you're an early child of God and be restored to your first love and come back whole? Say, God, forgive me. I've reflected upon you. I haven't loved you as I should. My faith's been weak. I've sinned before you. I haven't taken you seriously. I haven't done what I ought. I haven't been devoted and consecrated and dedicated to that which I believe. And forgive me of it. And I'm going to do better. I'm going to live right. I'm not going to be indifferent and apathetic. And I'm not going to just treat Christianity as an avocation, a sideline. It's going to be my all. Why not come today? Right now, while we stand.